sunshine. Give me a do. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good friends. Give me a do.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
Memorial Day means serious savings at Sleep Outfitters. Save up to $1,500 store-wide. Tempur-Pedic and Sealy adjustable sets are now up to $500 off. Or get a king purple mattress for the price of a queen. Plus, free next day delivery and setup. And our exclusive lifetime price guarantee locks in your best price forever. The Sleep Outfitters Memorial Day sale, going on now. You don't want to miss it. Only at Sleep Outfitters.
A Rayo Original Podcast.
Baroness Lola Young, your chronological age is 75. Your biological age is...
bad. Oh my God.
Welcome to What's My Age Again, the podcast where we test your biological age against the number of years you have lived on this earth. In this life, anyway. I am so excited for this week's guest. At 8 weeks old, she was handed from her Nigerian parents to a 64-year-old white war widow in North London. By 14, that foster mother had died. By 18, the state was done with her. Today, she walks through the gilded corridors of the House of Lords as Baroness Lola Young, actor, professor, cultural critic, crossbench peer, anti-slavery campaigner, chancellor of the University of Nottingham, and one of the most outspoken voices on modern slavery and ethical fashion in Britain. She has spent a lifetime looking directly at injustice, racism, exploitation, the trauma of children in care, and the brutal truth of who makes our clothes. So the question is, what has all of that done, Baroness, to your body? Has a life of carrying other people's pain sped up her biological clock, or has purpose, intellect, and a refusal to fear aging kept her younger than her years? She's 75, which is already astounding. But what is her real age? Baroness Lola Young, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
75. People don't think you're 75. Are people surprised?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. What very kind of... much so. And it becomes slightly embarrassing because you don't want to be like, oh, yes, well, of course, everybody tells me I'm looking lots younger than that. I don't want to be like that. But yeah. By the same token, I don't want to pretend like, oh, really? You know, because even sometimes I look at myself and think, what's going on here? So it usually comes out, you know, in the conversation about children. And yeah. I say, well, I have a son. And they say, oh, how old?
Oh, no.
And I said, yeah, he's 42.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, because I have the same, my daughter's 16, and now I look like I could have a 16-year-old daughter. But for a time when I would tell them her age, I could see their brain being like, old or slag? And I'd be like, both. Both. It's the age-old game, old or slag.
But don't you think it's funny when we say that, when we say, oh, you don't look your
right.
age? Because what does that mean about what you should look like when you're that age? Who's telling us how we should look when we're 75 or 65 or 25?
Well, can I say to you, I don't often speak ill of the dead, especially a wonderful woman who fostered children. But when I saw your new book, 8 Weeks, the woman who took you in is on this cover. It's only 64. Now, we know white women age like milk, but this is ridiculous. A 64-year-old, isn't Elizabeth Hurley 64 in a bikini? And yeah, what has happened to this lady?
But it's the time, isn't it? It's the period. That was, so that would have been, well, I wasn't a year old then on the cover of the book. So what would that be? 1950. So, no, 1951, I beg your pardon, 51, 52. So when did the Second World War ended in 1945? So yeah. We're talking about minimal amount of time to have been through all of those traumas, and it's an entirely different time. She was born in the 19th century in 1886,
That's
the
wild.
Days of empire.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, she didn't look out of place. There weren't other people going around saying, oh my God, she looks so old.
No.
That was the kind of norm. It's only from my long, long perspective, things have changed dramatically over the years.
You're absolutely right. Even so recently as The Golden Girls, which is one of my favorite shows on TV, they would speak about being past their prime, and Blanche would say, oh, I'm 36. I'll never meet a man now. I'm 42. It was, I think, the hairstyles that these older women had. They had
and the clothes.
And the clothes.
Definitely the clothes.
The lack of skincare. And,
yeah, exactly.
So what did you know about that woman's life and her trauma? And what did she talk to you as a foster mother about the war?
No, she didn't. She would often say, oh, I've just got my widow's pension. That's all I've got to look after you. Because the situation was that although they were meant to be paying her, my parents were meant to be paying her to look after me, or my mother was, she very, very rarely did. It was irregular. And it was like, again, to put the time in perspective, it was £2 a week was considered a pretty fair whack for looking after a child, you know, in those days. So, it was this situation where she didn't divulge much of her private life. But looking back, I can deduce certain things, particularly as I have my care records. So if I can just explain, the house that we lived in belonged to her biological daughter. I didn't know it belonged to her at the time. But so her biological daughter lived on the second floor of the house, big Victorian terrace. Then Daisy's biological granddaughter lived on the next floor with her great grandchildren. So there were these generations of Daisy's daughters and granddaughters and grandsons, great grands. Oh God, I get lost in all those great things. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like that generational thing.
The descendants. The house was full of descendants.
Interrupted, as I like to think of it, by on the ground floor, the upper ground floor. What was called in those days a spinster couple.
Ah, a spinster couple just would be lesbians today.
Yeah.
I love that.
It would almost be assumed today, but nobody would care at the same time.
Yeah.
So it was an extraordinary house. And so her history, as it were, her history was kind of mapped out with the generations, but she would never really tell us any personal details. I found out quite a lot when I was writing the book.
So eventually you accessed your care records, and we'll get back to that. But at the time, I think it would have been emblematic of that generation not to be extremely forthcoming and to button it up, keep calm, carry on, and not to share. But was she a loving foster mother?
Yeah, this is a question that people ask me, and I try to be honest about it because at the time I never felt loved. So, but then she looked after me without being paid. And this caused huge ructions with her daughter, who, if you remember that sort of topography of the house, lived on the first or second floor. Huge rows, which I didn't really know what they were about, but subsequently my sort of suspicions were confirmed. It was about me, because what her daughter was saying was, why are you using your money on this Nigerian girl? And actually she went to the Nigerian embassy. The daughter went to the Nigerian embassy to try and get them to take me back, as it were. So that's what they, but I just used to see these huge flare-ups, and then they wouldn't talk to each other for about 3 weeks afterwards. They'd pass each other, you know, in the hallway to the garden when they're hanging out the washing, not speak to each other.
And who knew that would probably set you up for a very comfortable job in the House of Lords, because that's really the sentiment over there. You've got Nigel Farage jumping down the corridor. You're like, I've lived like this since I was small.
No. It was... What it might have done, actually, you kind of sparked something there, was like observing people's behavior, observing the tone of what people say, observing their facial expressions and what we'd now call body language, because that was a matter of survival anyway. You know, you had to try and read people because you weren't in an expressive society or community. You had to try and read what was going on and listen very carefully. And I was always that kind of observant person. And I was very sort of inwardly turned. I would read and read and read. And I always say that's what kind of helped me, really. Saved my life, if you like, in some respects.
Yeah. So do you know what went on with your parents that you were turned over to care at 8 weeks?
Oh my gosh, it's so complicated, Catherine. Yeah. I mean, it's just ridiculously complicated. So basically, they weren't married to each other, mother, father, in Nigeria, both bright you know, eventually professional people. Yeah. My mother came over to study nursing. They'd been in a relationship. She was a widow, by the way. My mother was a widow. And so it was widely expected that they would get married. But then, so my father was still in Nigeria whilst my mother was here. Unbeknownst to her, he got another woman pregnant and their family said, you've got to marry her. So I had this half-sister who's 2 years older than me on that side. And then my mother had two sons by her husband that had died. So I have these two half or had these two half brothers too. Mm-hmm. My father comes over to London to study, but actually shacks up with my mother. And then his wife back in Lagos is like, okay, what's going on over there? Because everybody had known that they were, you know, lovers before. So she says, I'm going over there. So she comes over to London and then my father goes back to her, leaving my mother with me. So I'm not clear about at what stage exactly these things happened. And part of my desire to see my care records was to find out, you know, everybody wants to know their origins, don't they? No matter how sort of troubled they might be. And I wanted to know, but it wasn't really revealed in the care notes. Other things were, which were quite interesting, let's say, but not that.
Suffice to say, you had really smart, really accomplished, good, loving parents, but it was complicated, as it is in many relationships today. And your mother was probably had everything that it would take to be a sound mother, but these complications meant she decided to put you into care.
As you might imagine, I kind of vacillate between different positions on that. You know, there's a part of me that as a mother, so how could you give away your 8-week-old baby, you know, to this stranger effectively? She didn't, you know, Daisy was recommended, but, you know, didn't know her personally. How could you do that to an 8-week-old baby? Yeah. And the thing is, you say about loving parents, but they came to see me. I probably saw my mother maybe 4 times before she left when I was 7. Okay. And my father a few more than that, and actually stayed a weekend with him and his wife who knew about me. Mm-hmm. She was very kind, actually. But I would never identify them as being loving because to me, you even if you felt forced to give away your child because you were mentally incapacitated or something, you would want to have a connection. Yeah. And there was, and this was vindicated, my memories were vindicated in the care notes. There'd be a little thing in handwriting, of course, because no computers, that says, mother visited, baby cried, or father sent box of chocolates for her 5th birthday, you know, and it's like, what's that about? You know, there was no expression. I never felt that I was loved by anybody, going back to your original question. Yeah. But yeah.
I was trying to find some love, but no, like your conclusion is I never felt that I was loved.
No.
Did you think that led you to feel that you weren't worthy of love? Did you have tumultuous romantic relationships or friendships or any other choice later on that was geared towards like, I'm not worthy of love?
Yes, I think so. And I think, again, it's a pattern that gets repeated with a lot of people who feel that they've been abandoned in childhood. I'm in a strange demographic, if you like, so that you'll be aware that lots of adults came over from Jamaica and the Caribbean in the late 40s, early 50s, and people from Indian subcontinent and so on came over a bit later than that in greater numbers. And then there was this kind of population of mainly West African students like my parents who's studying medicine, law, whatever. And so they were adults. So the children weren't there. So I was often the one. So at my primary school, I think I was the 2nd black child there in North London. And then at secondary school, which was a girls' comprehensive, 1,100 students. Well, I think I could have counted all of the black girls that were there on one hand. Mm-hmm. So if you translate that into the possibility of romantic relationships, especially during that period, I mean, white boys to me were the ones who would shout at me, call me names, spit at me, throw money at me as on my way to school.
Yeah.
And black boys weren't, you know, were few and far between. And also I was very kind of awkward and this kind of, I'm not worthy. I'm unloved because I deserve to be unloved. And I think, as I say, a lot of kids who are in the care system feel like that, feel like it's their fault that things haven't worked out.
And what kind of mother are you?
Oh,
like when, because I'm sure that it brings a lot of it back when you have a small baby, when they reach that milestone of 8 weeks and every milestone thereafter, you know, probably brings up a lot of things for you.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I guess in my mid-20s, I sort of vowed I was never going to have children because I didn't want them to. You know, I read all of this material. Sometimes I think I read too much, but there was a load of material which said, oh, if you've been in the care system, you're likely to replicate that situation. You know, a lot of kids who are in care have had parents that been in care, and I thought, well, that, you know, that was like some kind of genetic stain, you know, that I'd never get rid of. Yeah,
there's literature like that.
Well, because it's, you know, I'm gonna say it's true. I mean, obviously I could have, I had a, let's say, not an in-depth reading of that material, but there is plenty of research which suggests a lot of children and people who've been in care, particularly women who've been in care, often end up having to have their children taken away. So, you know, that's something that happens, still. So I didn't think that it was a good idea. And maybe I recognized something in myself that maybe I thought because I felt unloved, I wouldn't be able to love. Because love involves trust, right? Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, when you've been, again, when you've been in that situation, you don't really trust a lot of people because there's this sort of continually you're let down. People who, you know, people are paid to look after you. So what kind of investment have they got in your welfare or your intellectual development? On the contrary, some of them would be like, you know, oh, you think you're above us kind of attitude. Yeah. So all of that made it quite difficult. But then I, for some reason, for some strange reason, it came into my head I was going to go to drama school. So when I was in my early 20s, I decided to go into acting. And there, it's like the world is your oyster, right? Yeah. Especially in terms of boyfriends. I think we'll have to skate over a lot of those details, let's say.
You had famous boyfriends?
No. But lots of bad decisions.
Oh, fine, yeah.
Yeah, lots of bad decisions.
I appreciate your discretion. You skate over those details. I make those details the body of my work.
Well, yeah.
I'm like, but let me tell you about him.
I think that's a generational thing as well, because that's a logical development of a society which is more able to be more expressive and more honest. So, of course, people are going to go out there and sort of test the limits of that.
Yeah.
Why not?
I certainly do. But also in the thespian world, I think you'd find some really interesting boys to go out with.
Yeah.
Mostly gay.
Yes, there were quite a few.
We've all had gay boyfriends in high school.
I've been there, done that.
Yeah.
but there was also this thing of being a little bit on the exotic. I suppose I'd look back now, and in fact, even one person referred to me and my life as being exotic. And I said, well, that's not how I experienced it. But, you know, because there was a lot of very, very white, very middle class people, a lot of privately educated. I'd not come across this thing before. You know, I've been brought up on the mean streets of, well, I say mean streets of Highbury because that's what it was then. I mean, you don't think of that now in Islington and the Angel and all that's very she, but it wasn't in the 50s and 60s.
No.
So this privately educated, what did that even mean? You know, I didn't understand.
So hang on, how did you get into a drama school with all these privately educated white boys?
I don't know.
What did you have to do?
Well,
audition.
In the drama school, funnily enough, was a huge majority were women.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't like what you'd call top tier. So I did audition for, I think I auditioned for Lambda as was, the London Academy, I didn't get in there. But I got into this new College of Speech and Drama, which offered the safety net of a teaching diploma or degree, or no, well, not a degree, a teaching diploma. So that if I failed totally at acting, I could have gone on to teach English, drama, whatever. So, So,
and who was cheering you on to do something like this? Because if you...
friends are looking at me, I think they must have been saying, what the heck is she on? You know, because it's like, it must have come out of the blue to them because it kind of came out of the blue to me. You know, I sort of thought, I'd been doing some amateur dramatics and found I quite liked it. And because, you know, believe it or not, I was quite shy and introverted, and I didn't like being in sort of big social occasions. Well, not that I had many, but I, you know, I found it, I was awkward. So a friend and I decided we'd go to AmDram. And it, that was hilarious in so many ways, because again, the director didn't know what to do with these two black girls. You know, he had to kind of write special pieces for us and, you know, all of this. Yeah, it, that scene has changed so much in so many different and interesting ways.
I love that you had the confidence and fortitude, even feeling unloved, not worthy of love, being introverted, that you and your friend just went out there and did that.
Well, I think it's because... And I think this relates to later life, and it'd be interesting when we get to the blood work. Because I think what I've done is to make myself entirely independent and resilient in a way that sometimes does, you know, exclude people, because I, that kind of taken to its extreme, that's what it can do.
Yeah.
So my feeling was, well, look, I don't have my Nigerian parents telling me I've got to go and study accountancy or law or medicine. Yeah. I can do what I like. And so let's give it a go, because I didn't want to be in a position whereby, you know, a bitter and twisted old woman saying, oh, if only I'd gone into theatre, I could have been a movie star or anything like that. So, which I wasn't, of course, but, you know.
Not yet.
No, but I had a great, I can't complain about my career in rep theatre.
And you worked on the BBC, and you had a long stint in this amazing children's show, and you did loads of things.
Metal Mickey,
Do you think you had a desire to be someone else? Is that part of acting?
I think there must always be an element of that. Being able to be, to present yourself in a different way. And maybe that's particularly acute for people who've been in similar situations. Doesn't always mean you have to have been in care, but in a situation where you feel yourself isn't acceptable who you are. So let's see if we can be somebody else and get that acceptance or respect or whatever in doing that work. But I also think, and this carries on to much later as well, I think into my career, that it's that thing of wanting to be visible.
Yeah.
Because I did, in fact, my initial sort of draft title for the book was Invisible, because that's how I felt when I was young. So, you know, then I wanted to be visible. Now I want to have that visibility is now I'm totally visible.
Yeah.
And so now it's about legacy, you know, what am I leaving behind? And I think that acting thing was, I can do what I want because I'm completely free. Whereas my friends, on the university track and great people, you know, in public service and all of that, maybe the first generation of women who felt that they, it wasn't something unusual to go into a career as opposed to getting married and settling down. So going to university from a comprehensive school, you know, was a great thing to do. But I didn't get enough good grades in my A levels. Mm-hmm. As I explained to people, I was trying to study in a room where kids were running around. You know, I was in a children's home. The first one was about 14 kids. The second one was about the same number. The last one was fewer kids. It was only 7. But it's like, you know, I was studying in the playroom because there isn't a place for people to study.
And so was this with Daisy, the aforementioned foster mother that you had? She fostered other children as well.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes. I left all of that out. Yeah.
Actually, you didn't leave it out. I think I was waiting. But let's go back to the notes because I think we can't avoid them because there are lots of gaps without it. So what year did you access your notes? 2012?
Yes, it was around 2012. It took me, it was a combination of Islington Council having difficulty in finding them, which I kind of, you know, to be honest with you, I'm totally amazed because, you know, I've got a thick folder from the 1950s, from when I was 8 weeks old until I was 18, with lots of detail. So, yeah, it took a while, but it also took a while for me to face that reality because I didn't even know you could get your notes, even though by then I'd been in the House of Lords for several years, but I didn't even know that. And it was a friend who was a probation officer somebody I'd known who's still great friends with from school.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, you know, you can get your notes. Oh my God. You may not, because, you know, it's a long time ago and things happen, but give it a go. This is who you got to contact. So, but it took me a long while to say, yes, I'm going to do this. I really am going to do this.
A Rayo Original Podcast. A Rayo Original Podcast.
What were your fears about reading the details of your time in care?
Yeah, I was afraid there might be material about my parents that would be even more difficult to absorb. You know, I thought maybe, I don't know what I thought might be in there. I thought there might be, as my friend warned me and I kind of sussed myself, some of the language would be difficult because we don't use that kind of language about people today. So lots of times in my notes, when I did finally get them, the social workers referred to me as a large Nigerian girl. And there's this whole thing about big muscles and, you know, which is one of those kind of mythological things about, or stereotypical things about black people, yeah. You know, big and hefty and so on. And Nigerian. I guess to them I was Nigerian, but I didn't feel like that. So yeah, I was a bit afraid. I didn't know what was going to be in there. And also I'd been a bit naughty in some of the children's homes. I wasn't a saint by any means. And I thought, oh, maybe what did I do there? What did I do at that home? Because I know they didn't like me, you know. Aww. But anyway, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be in some respects. But by the same token, there's one thing that's outstanding in there, and that's a letter, which I reproduce, just redact the name and the address and everything, because I wasn't expecting to find like original documents in the folder.
Wow.
So although I've got photocopies, obviously, but there's a postcard that I sent to my social worker. There's a letter that I sent to my social worker saying how depressed I was, and I was told I was a burden on the people who ran the children's home.
What age is this?
About, 15, 14, 15. Very difficult age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So piecing together your memories and now details from your file, what can you tell us about living in care? Like in a nutshell, I know you really go into it in the book, but.
Well, I think what I would say, and obviously with the benefit of hindsight and reflection and being a great old age full of wisdom, what I can say is that if you look at the context, we're in the 1950s and 1960s. So thankfully, I'm sort of, you know, pretty well educated on that period in terms of lots of different things. So I can look back on that and say that was a horrible experience. And it was... being in care was made worse, if you like, by being black at a time when there were so few black people around on television, nothing like that. I mean, you know, it was completely barren landscape as far as that goes. So the thing was about being black, about being in care, and but also being quite clever and able to read and read books far in advance of what I should have been reading. So all of that's a kind of big jumble. But the main thing, when I speak to young people today and I say to them, for example, I say, oh my gosh, it was awful. When you're 18, that's it. You're out of care. Off you go. You know, and unless you've got a really good foster parent that wants you to keep you and you want to stay with them, if you're lucky, that might happen, but often it doesn't. So you're on your own kind of thing. And, you know, and if you think about things that your parents or whoever's caring for you would normally do, they would sort of inherently, you'd learn how to cook a little bit, how to save money or spend money or whatever, look after yourself, but you're thrust into this adult world. So now what the kids call it is the care cliff. You fall off the cliff. So in that respect, what that's taught me is that the emotional landscape is very similar to what it was when I was in the care system, but it's just that some of the contextual details have changed.
And your little handwriting is in here too. I was just trying to look back at the letters and stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That is amazing. That is so much detail.
It's like my 15-year-old self. I mean, that was a real kind of trying to say it without using four letter words, but you know, it's like a real kind of, oh my gosh, what's going on here?
You're allowed to say mind fuck on this show.
That's what it was. It was a mind fuck. Yeah. Because it was like, oh, you know, when people ask you that question, what would you say to your 15-year-old self? And here was my 15-year-old self telling me at whatever it was, 60 or whenever it was I first read them. Yeah. So, yeah, that was weird. But also seeing this letter from this woman who didn't even look after me in the end, but I'd been sent to see her as a prospective foster. Yeah, because big bit I've left out. When Daisy died,
yes,
I went to another foster home. Then I was taken into a children's home in Hertfordshire, but I was still going to school not far from here. I used to come down here all the time, Parliament Hill School.
Okay.
So that journey involved, I guess it's 20 minutes, but it felt like 20 hours, a 20-minute walk from the children's home. It's in Hertfordshire, it's in a village in the Hertfordshire countryside, to the station in the dark in the winter because it gets dark so early.
Yeah.
And with no paving either side and cars all whizzing by, you know, on my own, no lighting. And so that was like a living nightmare. And the way I got over that was to invent this person, this being who hated light.
Okay.
So I would have to revel in the darkness and be very upset if I saw a car coming towards me with lights because I didn't want to see any lights. Or if the moon was out, I didn't want to. So it was a way of trying to deal with that situation. But fundamentally, it kind of nearly broke me, actually. And so they kept trying to find places nearer to my school because I refused to leave school.
Yeah.
They wanted me to go to a local school. I said, no, I'm not going. My friends are there. It's the only thing I've got, the only stable thing I've got. So this woman I went to see, I mean, I was going to say, I don't know how to describe it, but I do. It's in there. But she...
Is it another four-letter word, Lola?
No, it isn't. It's beyond.
Oh.
It's beyond all of that. It's more I'd kind of resort to literature. Like I always felt it's like going to see the fall of the House of Usher. So it's like a big terraced house in Highbury, near Highbury Fields. I went to see it the other day, still there, the house. And the family was this woman who allegedly wanted to be a foster mother to me and her husband, a grown-up son in his mid-20s and a daughter. Now, the daughter had cerebral palsy, but so this woman, the mother of this 20-year-old, 19-year-old young woman, just said, oh, that's my daughter, she's a... and just kind of left her sweeping. So it felt like she was kind of like doing all the housework in this kind of slightly awkward way that she had because of her muscle spasm. Anyway, it was, so there was all of this and all of these things happened. I was there for about 45 minutes or an hour on my own, no social worker accompanying me. And, you know, to me, that was kind of the end of it. I looking back, I thought, no, I didn't like that place, didn't want to go. And then... In there, there's a letter from that woman, a character assassination of me.
No.
Yeah. It was shocking. I did find it so shocking that I really did that classic thing of scrubbing myself in very hot water.
Oh.
Because it brought so many things back, you know, so many feelings back of that nobody wants, you know, and it's like, it was horrible. It's the power of words. And it was like a 2 or 3 page handwritten letter. As I say, it is in there. And, it's quite shocking the assessment she makes of me on the basis of that very short meeting. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have loads of coping mechanisms for all of this trauma.
Mm.
Pretending to be someone who reveled in the darkness and this hyper-independence is absolutely a trauma response.
Mm.
And it's amazing how accessing your records, even all those years later, reading a rejection from a woman that you didn't want to live with anyway, takes you right back to being like a rejected child.
Well, in fact, you say I didn't want to live with anyway. That's how I thought I felt at the time, right? That's my memory of it.
Yeah.
But when I looked in the notes... What the people at the children's home said was that after that meeting, I went back to the home and started packing my suitcase and saying I was going to go and live with them. So, you know, that again was kind of like, what is going on? What was going on? And, you know, there's an extent to which it's impossible to remember because you're in a way, you know, even as I tell you, I'm telling you the memory of a memory of a memory of a memory.
We do. We have so many constructed memories and decisions we make afterwards, and it's very difficult. One thing that jumps out to me, just as a mother, really being hyper aware of how vulnerable these children are in the system, even though I've never experienced it myself, I'm glad that you talk about it so often in your advocacy and, of course, in your book, is as soon as you said to me, I went to this house and they had an adult son who was 20, that scares me a little bit because I don't like the idea. I just don't know how safe children are. If you take a young woman who would have been 14, 15 and put her with a 20-year-old man.
He was 27, actually.
27?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Like, how I won't even let my 16-year-old daughter sleep anywhere that there is an adult man. And I know that that might sound crazy to a lot of people, but how much of a risk is that in the system?
Well, I mean, even then, when we, you know, you say that now, and I would say that now, but that's now. And again, there's a particular context around that because we're so aware of now of the abuse that's been going on, and we're much more, not so much aware, because I think we, as women, have always been aware of the amount of misogyny and violence against women, but it's much more open about that. But even then, I was surprised, and looking back, I was surprised that the social worker let me go on my own to that house anyway. I think things are better because there is that awareness, but that doesn't mean that things, you know, are okay, because you can read. There are so many times I read stories about, not just, you know, we think of sexual abuse particularly because that's so kind of current today, but it's not just about that. It's about emotional abuse. It's about telling kids they're stupid.
Yeah.
Why are you bothering? Don't do this. Ripping up their homework because you don't want them to be cleverer than you are. You know, all of these things that kind of go on. And this, because children obviously are the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
Not only do they have very, in theory, they have rights, but they're not able to exercise those rights without the help of and support of an adult. And so you've got to get a trusted adult, and it's really, really difficult. So, you know, I do feel for children and young people in the system and when they first leave, because in some respects, at 18, well, you know what, 16 to 18, because you can leave care at 16, actually. Can you imagine your daughter, you know, with even now with your support and your husband's support and everything, just kind of leaving and going, being left on her own more or less to sort out her life?
Well, she'd be falling off a care cliff because I have not taught her to cook and I have not taught her about finances. And I think modern parenting is not great, actually. I need to step it up. I need to be a lot more Nigerian in many areas of my life.
But don't give them away.
No, I just need to have some like smart books around the house, really prioritize like science and law. Is this how you pivoted into advocacy for modern slavery? Because when you spoke about the daughter who had a physical disability, basically being a cleaner for the house, is that all linked?
That's really interesting because I hadn't made that direct connection. And that's one of the fascinating things about talking about this stuff, is that people bring these other insights into it. So I hadn't made that direct connection, but now I think about it, you're right, because we were talking about yesterday how this, the first time I got really involved in this was I was asked to make an amendment to a law in 2009 to criminalize domestic servitude and forced labor. Mm-hmm. And most people, even in the House of Lords, said, well, surely that's already a criminal offense. I said, no, it wasn't. It was a civil tort. So if we wanted to make that a crime, which brings up all kinds of other things like the possibility of compensation, et cetera, you know, we really need to nail this law. The then Labour government weren't very happy about it for various reasons, but we tested them and in the end they gave in and we got this on the statute books. And that was in 2009. And that was then, so Anti-Slavery International, great charity, oldest human rights advocacy in the country, I think, if not the world. And they said, would I be patron? So then I got to learn more about it. Then people started talking about supply chains. I'm going, what's a supply chain? You know, this is in 2010. And then people are saying, look, you know, there's this whole area of ethical fashion, but people in Parliament aren't really paying much attention to it. MPs and peers aren't paying much. And I've always loved clothes and fashion. So I thought, right, let's get in there. And I was very fortunate, great group of women who said, look, you know, we'll tell you what we're doing and we'll tell you how you can help us via Parliament. So that's how I got into all of that and then realized what was going on in supply chains with, again, mainly women being in situations of forced labor, not only working extremely long hours, being locked into buildings, not being allowed to go to the toilet without permission, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but also with the additional threat very often of sexual abuse and harassment in those factories. So, you know, it's a huge field, a vast field. And I still engage with a lot of people from the fashion world, although I'm not primarily concentrating on that quite so much. Mm-hmm. That's not to say job done, because it will never be done. But there are other areas that people have persuaded me to get interested in, which has been quite difficult, very different world of construction. So don't start asking me about brick kilns and sand trafficking and all of that. Otherwise, we'll be here all day and you fall asleep probably.
And at 75, you're still evolving and growing and maybe going into that stuff and fighting for it. I think people would be shocked to know how much modern slavery goes on in the UK.
Definitely.
And that supply chain stuff that's in the UK.
Definitely as well, yeah. I mean, yesterday, not to show off or anything, but, you know, one of my roles you read out was a Chancellor of Nottingham University. And we were at St. James's Palace because we've been awarded amongst, I think there were 19 universities and colleges, had the Queen's anniversary award for in higher and further education to give it its full title. And Nottingham University received that award because of the Rights Lab. Mm. And the Rights Lab got the award because they've been doing this absolutely pioneering work using satellite technology to identify sites where there is trafficking and forced labor and child labor around the world, so that people can't then say, oh, well, we haven't got anything like that going on in our area, because they can pick this up. Please don't ask me about the technology, because I couldn't speak to that at all. But I do know that that data that they're producing and that the knowledge that's being generated through that work can help to transform the way in which we approach these issues, particularly, you know, around the world. So that was a great moment to have that work recognized.
That is wild. I won't ask you about the technology, but I would assume it's like heat. And they can see loads of people.
Just don't go there. You know, I did
protons.
It might as well be magic as far as I'm concerned.
Okay,
don't forget,
magic.
I was born in the last century, you know, so.
Well, I know we're not supposed to say it, but you don't look it. And you've done so much. So how did you become a baroness? The last we left you, we were at drama school.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. You have a lot of coping mechanisms for your traumatic upbringing. Mm. You're advocating for change in that department, but you don't think that a lot is different. Mm. And then how do you pivot from acting to lordship?
Quite. How do you do that? Okay, so there is a kind of continuity. I can see the thread. So from acting, I was very involved in the politics of representation. Mm-hmm. So there weren't enough black actors.
In what year were you involved in the politics of representation and acting?
1978, 1979. I think once I'd left college in 1976. Mm-hmm. Then I went to rep theatres, as I said before, and I got involved with Equity, the Actors Union.
Yes,
so did all of that. So I did a lot of committee work as I was involved in that. When I stopped acting, what did I do? Then I went into kind of arts, admin, development, training locally in Haringey, then got more known because of the committee work that I was doing for Arts Council, Heritage Lottery Fund and all those kinds of bodies, then I decided that having missed out on university, I wanted to know everything in the whole world there was to know.
Yeah.
And so I registered for a degree, an undergraduate degree. I did that, did well in that, then did a PhD, then started looking at areas of Black history at a time when that was relative, I'm not going to say new, but relatively low profile. And then all of a sudden, these museums and cultural institutions were ringing up Lola Young, who I think by then was a professor. I got to be a professor, one of the first Black women professors in the country, got all of that work under my belt. And then I went to the GLA, headed up the culture team there when Ken Livingstone was mayor during the Olympics and all of that. And then... Oh, yeah. Okay. So what happened? Tony Blair's government in 90, whatever it was, had set up this thing, the People's Peers. So you could get nominated or apply or both or whatever. And you would, you know, if you got through it, you would become a member of the House of Lords. And they did a big group. And the first time I went for it, I didn't get it. And they said that thing. They always say, oh, we'll keep your records on file just in case. And I thought, yeah. But then a few months later, I did get the call.
Oh, wow.
And so I said, oh, all right, then. Why not? Yeah. And there's this great thing I have to tell you that my son said, which is when I knew I'd done the right, I brought him up properly. When I told him, I just got this phone call and ran up the stairs and said to him, oh, God, I'm going to be a member of the House of Lords. And he said, that's great, Mum. Congratulations. Big hug and a kiss. And then he said, you do know now that you're part of the problem, right? So like to kind of keep me grounded and sort of realize that, and obviously I kind of knew that, but it's been a great thing. It's been sort of like in my head. And he was only like 16 or so, I think, at the time. So like he got all the political stuff.
He's great.
Which was great. So yeah, I can't believe that's 21 years I've been in the House of Lords now.
I think it's interesting to hear you condense that story because you minimize it so much. You're like, well, decided to pick up a university degree on the way home. Then casually got a PhD and then applied. You say it like it's the national like postcode lottery. Like then I just put my name in the hat to become a baroness and I got it. I think it was probably a lot more difficult and premium and hard to be given that title than the way you tell the story.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, and yeah, there are moments like, even like yesterday, as I say, we were at the palace in the morning, then there's a big dinner in the evening at Guildhall, and each time I had to wear these university robes, which are incredible, very heavy, lots of gold, real gold, and, you know, very grand, the Chancellor's robes. And I said to one of my fellow colleagues last night, I said, you know, I'd still find it a bit weird. Here I am in Guildhall as Baroness Young and Chancellor of the University. So it's not like I take it for granted or think, you know, I know in my head that the kind of wobbly moments that I've had where I thought, I hate that term imposter syndrome because don't want to do that. But there have been moments when I thought, has this really happened to me? How did this happen? Because there's a sense in which I still feel the same. And as I've kind of suggested, even, you know, my son and other friends will keep me grounded. I've still got four friends from school from when I was 11. The reason why I wanted to stay at that school and not change school. Yeah. And that was probably the biggest decision that I was able to make and did make that kind of kept me sane in some very, very difficult moments. Yeah, I had lots of depression and
It's good that they honored that, like the one constant, especially in a young woman's life. They've done these studies about how young women connect and how their brains work. And it's really important that they talk to other girls their age. Right. And that's why they say if you've got a teenage daughter who's upstairs on the telephone or interacting with her friends, that is so important for her neuroplasty.
Yes.
Do that. And so thank goodness they didn't take those friends
away.
That's
really interesting because one of the things... when my son was in his teens, there was all this kind of big panic about video nasties and video games.
Yeah.
And he used to play a lot of video games when he was in his teens. But what I observed was that his friends, his male friends would come round and they'd do it collectively then. It wasn't like, I know it's not so much. Well, it's collective in a different way now because the collectivity is online, but this is in person. Mm-hmm. And he and they would have phone conversations, and he would have conversations with girls of his age that weren't sort of sexually motivated. They were friends. Yeah. So I sort of took heart from that because I always thought it's going to be difficult to bring up a boy then, let alone now, but in a way that meant that they could, they needn't feel constrained about having a sensitive emotional side and so on. And that was difficult then. I think it's even more difficult now.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad he's approaching middle age. And thank me for saying that.
And you'll be a grandmother before you know it. I'm worried I'm going to be a grandmother while I still have small kids because I have a 16-year-old. She's not going to have kids anytime soon, but soon, even 10 years is soon.
10 years is soon.
And I will have a 10-year-old daughter in 10 years. And if I have grandkids on top of it, I'm going to look like this. This will be me on the second floor of Victorian home. So Baroness Lola Young, you have had, I mean, as detailed beautifully in your new book, 8 Weeks, a lot of trauma, developed some coping mechanisms, but continued to push forward and be like really hyper independent and effective and successful in your work anyway. How old do you feel most days?
So when I hit 70, I thought, oh, that's beginning to sound old, you know, because I never sort of thought of myself. And now, so I'm 75 this year and I'm thinking, ah, now that's beginning to sound really old because Daisy died when she was 78.
Well, but look, this, you're not living this life.
No, I'm not living that life.
You're out of the steel bath.
Yeah. And I'm grateful, you know, for that. And I'm able to, you know, eat well, you know, and my independence allows me to do whatever I want to do. So it's all on me. So I don't know about my, I suppose what I think more in terms of, because when I was younger, I almost never expected to live. You know, so I did have, I wasn't ever suicidal as such, but I did sort of think, oh God, you know, I wish this would all end, you know, because it's just, I'm just fed up with all of this. And that was at the peak of when I was in the third children's home and trying to struggle with exams and not doing so well and all the rest of it. And then when I got my exam results and afterwards, and there was a few moments in my sort of early 20s when I thought, oh, this is just rubbish. And then it wasn't, you know. So it's not that I try not to think about age, and I'm sort of resigned to the fact that I've not got another 75 years, right? Unless something miraculous happens in the world of science.
You might. If anyone does, you might. You eat really well. Tell me about your diet.
Well, I've been vegetarian, not eating meat since the late 70s. And I haven't eaten fish since the 80s. And I haven't drunk alcohol since probably, maybe 90s, early 90s or something like that. I was never a big drinker. Mm. You know, I'm not, I don't know whether that means I am an addictive personality or not, and that fear stops me from indulging in these things. But no, I don't sort of feel. I smoked very briefly when I thought it was cool to smoke, you know, Sobrani colored, you know, cigarette papers and everything. But yeah.
And what about exercise?
Exercise, my body loves exercise, right? So when I had this sciatica, before I had sciatica, I was playing walking football, I'd done netball, I'd learned how to fence, and I always walked, you know, when they used to say 10,000 steps, if I can't get 15,000 steps a day, what's going on here? Then the sciatica really, I don't know if you've ever had it or know anybody's had it. I hope you never have.
Thank you.
Excruciating. So that sort of pushed me back a lot. And now my osteopath says, oh, it's better you don't do football because the motion of kicking a ball. So I don't do that. But I'm still walking, gradually building up my steps again, walking. And I probably average about 8,000 or 9,000 steps a day.
With sciatica?
No. Well, the underlying condition is still there, but it doesn't hurt. I'm not on any medication. No.
Why doesn't it hurt?
So I got an osteopath, a very good osteopath.
Yeah.
I went to a woman who does Pilates for people in pain.
Wow. Oh.
And also is a trained osteopath. And I did therapeutic massages. And I had loads of very heavy duty painkillers for a year or so.
Okay.
To quell it. And then the further down it goes, the more exercise you can do, the better it is.
Wow.
So the situation is that I don't have to have these treatments every week now, as I was doing, but maybe once every 2 months or so.
That's
just
great.
To keep. Yeah.
So you feel well, you're living well.
Yeah, yeah.
You look young. You're tackling something in construction next.
Yes.
TBC.
Yes, 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 yes.
Would you like to find out what your biological age is?
Yeah, I'm really interested, and I will be questioning Nikki.
Well, let's bring her out. Let's have Dr. Nicola Conlon on hand to interpret the results of your biological age test.
Give me a mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine. Something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing Mountain Dew. So give me my good friends, give me a Dew.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
Baroness Lilla Young, we took your blood and the people at Glycanage tested it. And now we're joined by Dr. Nicola Conlon, science woman, to reveal your biological age. Nicola is more than just a science woman. She's dedicated her entire career to human longevity and has over a decade of research in cellular aging. So there is no one better to interpret these results. Baroness Lilla Young, your chronological age is 75. Your biological age is... 79. That's not bad.
Whoa.
That's not bad.
Oh my God.
What's your initial reaction?
Oh, wow. I better go out and do all the things I need to do before I pop my clogs.
Well, Nicola, what can you tell us about this result?
So it is slightly higher, but it's definitely not dramatic. And obviously, I've been sitting listening to the incredible conversation that you've had with Catherine, and you've been through a lot in your life, so much. And we do know that people that have experienced things like trauma, you know, stress throughout life, it does leave an imprint on the body.
Mm-hmm.
So to be quite honest, I really think this is quite a good result, actually. Have you ever done any kind of therapy for any of...
No.
Okay, very interesting.
No.
And because you speak with such, you know, you're so optimistic, you don't speak like you've been through a hard time. But sometimes what we know is the body almost can remember some of this.
Yeah,
this,
the body keeps the score.
Exactly,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
Exactly that. And what this test is actually measuring is the amount of inflammation in the body.
Wow.
So we know that inflammation or higher levels of inflammation technically will make us age faster at the cellular level. And everything to do with aging starts in our cells, a bit
sure.
deeper in our body than, you know, what we see, feel, and experience on the outside. And we know that stress is one of the primary drivers of the aging process.
Mm.
And I think what's interesting, and there's been some interesting data recently when it comes to therapy, is not the traditional types of therapies like, you know, talking therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, but more like somatic based therapies where your body is almost holding onto the tension. And what that means is that your sort of stress system is almost recalibrated to a higher level of resilience, which might seem like a good thing as to be more resilient, but at the body level, it's kind of like your body's operating at this higher level of stress constantly. So I just think it'd be really interesting, maybe like to think about some sort of like doing some sort of...
What are somatic therapies?
So somatic therapies is, it's very different. So, you know, traditional types of therapy would be talking about the trauma and going through it and things like that.
Because that bit, that sounds like you know how to do that yourself.
Mm.
You have reconciled a lot of this.
Mm.
You've turned it around. You're an advocate. You're helping people. So yeah, talking therapy, you do it on your walks, probably.
Yeah, you know, and this is much more thinking about when you have that emotional response to things, where do you hold it in your body?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And different people hold the tension in different parts of the body. So I'm by no means a trained therapist in this way, but the sort of idea behind it is that it's a lot less about talking through it, but more having small amounts of exposure and bringing up some of the memories and thoughts, and then actually almost listening to your body of like, where is this? Why are you feeling this? Is this, you know, in your throat? Is it tight here? Mm. Is it in your back? Is it, you know, some people it's in their gut. They're really holding.
Back will be the sciatica.
But yeah, you've done it.
You know, it could be, but it's very interesting. And we do see that when people do this, they get meaningful reductions in inflammation.
Right,
I think it's very interesting to look at that link.
Because that's what sciatica is, isn't it? It's inflammation of the sciatic nerve.
Yeah.
And that runs all the way down the both sides of the body. Mm. And that, I mean, I attributed it first starting to lockdown. It was all the sitting down I thought was very bad. But talk about traumatic experiences. There's, you know, one or two that I wouldn't go into, I'll tell you off mic or whatever. But, you know, that again, I think you referred earlier to absorbing other people's pain. I do sometimes have a physical feeling when I'm talking to people or even hearing over the phone of something. I've always thought it was like just a high degree of empathy, so that, you know, somebody telling me about a physical pain or mental anguish will produce that response. But
That's really interesting, because you hear about people saying they get in their heads. So some people, the way they respond to, you know, whether that's negative thoughts or they're replaying things in the mind. Other people, they have a reaction that's very different, where they almost are like shutting it out the mind, but it's in the body.
Yes,
so you can't quite say why you've got that low level anxiety all the time, but then you kind of become used to it. And that's your normal kind of stress operating system. Mm. And we do know that in studies of people that are kind of have that elevated stress response, it does tend to push the biological age up. But I think what surprised me is that it's not higher than it is, just given the amount. And I think that really goes back to everything else that you are doing right. You know, your diet you were talking about. So we look at different patterns of different markers. And one of them that did stand out was the one that usually looks good in people with a good diet and lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So having the good diet in terms of being, you know, vegetarian, eating lots of plants, we know that that does help bring inflammation down. Exercise, it sounds like you're doing everything right there. So I think those things are definitely pulling it back.
It's the hard bit.
In the right direction. So that's really
positive. Oh, that is interesting. So, right, I shall be looking up and reading about somatic therapy.
Somatic therapy. So the soma is the body.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How interesting. What an interesting field of study.
It's a very interesting field. You know, it's looking at how we can, you know, I'm laughing when you're talking about this book with the picture on the front of Daisy, of like how we are aging so differently now. And I think we, you know, a lot of us have these longer lifespans. So now it's all about how do we live that in good health? Because unfortunately, a lot of people are living longer, but we're not living healthy. And, you know, certainly a lot of people are not in your position where they're Chancellor of the University and Baroness and doing all these amazing things. And people would never guess when you tell them your chronological age, because that's, for unfortunately, for a long time we've been sort of stereotyped to think that that age is, oh, it's winding down, you know, it's not doing all these things, but that's changing.
I'd be really interested in studies with children and young people who've been in the care system, and particularly care leavers, if it was possible. You know, there'd be some interesting research, wouldn't there, to do around this concept. I don't know if people are working on that, and that could track them through their years, because I would bet, given what you've just said, that a lot of people who've been through the system would have higher, you know, these higher sort of stress indicators in their blood.
Yeah, I think we would absolutely be seeing something like that and those patterns. And this sort of technology is quite new. So this idea of measuring our biological age, how old we are at the on the inside, is only really come about over the last 10 years. So we don't really have that huge backlog of data that we can use. But we're starting to see now studies in a lot of different types of groups of people. So, you know, we're looking in women, for example, going through the menopause, some big studies there. We're looking at, there's studies on war veterans with PTSD. There's studies now that they're doing on people that are entrepreneurs and, you know, burning the candle at both ends. So there's lots of different groups that seem to flag up as the people that are having these higher biological ages. So I do think you're correct. It's people that are unfortunately experiencing things that aren't so great and kind of having to live their life on high alert, essentially.
Oh, high alert. Yes. Yeah, and I also think just saying that and using that phrase, I mean, high alert, absolutely. I mean, I just, I know it's similar with a lot of parenting, but you know, I sort of think, oh my gosh, you know, what's he doing? How, you know, who's he with? My son, you know, is he safe? And with that added layer of what happens to black boys, black and brown boys, you know, stopped by the police and all of that. So you are, a lot of black people I know are hypervigilant because we know what can happen. So it is a really important area of study because then if you look at that in relation to particular diseases that afflict black people that are stress related, like heart disease and so on and so forth, you know, there's this added layer that we're not even necessarily aware of. That's really interesting. Yeah.
It's a constant state, I imagine, of vigilance and assessment. And the double layer of being young black female in the care system, you're probably always on high alert, as Nicola said, and that would alter your stress response.
Yeah. I mean, there was one incident I was involved in and you know, where I was present at where, you know, there was physical peril, let's say. And that was, I felt okay afterwards. You know, everybody else is kind of freaking out and, you know, on my behalf, as it were. And I said, I'm all right. And then it kind of manifested itself maybe several months later with some really bad, what they call parasomnia. That's what the psychotherapist said when I explained to her what had happened, because we were allocated, you know, some time with a psychotherapist as a result of this thing. And so I had these kind of, they're like hallucinations. So it's not like nightmares. It's like you think it's real, and I got up out of bed and acted as if I'd really seen what I thought I'd seen and all the rest of it. And she said, oh yeah, that's parasomnia, look it up, and blah 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 blah. And so that went on for some time, and I guess looking back that was a kind of belated response to the incident. But at the time, of course, I was like, not gung-ho, but I was kind of okay. You know, I felt I was okay, but I was hypervigilant. Kind of like, you know, I remember wearing a rucksack and thinking, oh, that's good in case somebody comes and tries to stab me in the back. You know, it's that kind of rational that's irrational at the same time.
Yeah, and most normal people wouldn't be having those thoughts because they've never been through that. So that is like your system is reset to a different level of normal. That is actually that hypervigilance. And then the fact that, you know, you're having those events during the night when, you know, it's almost like your conscious mind is shut it out. But when you're going into that state of, you know, dreams, REM sleep, things like that, your unconscious is then almost bringing it to the surface. That, you know, when you dream, that's kind of what happens. Your brain is trying to pick apart different things and make sense of it all.
You're not going to get away with this.
It's like, okay, we're going to deal with this right now.
Okay.
Well, I think somatic therapy is a really great takeaway from today and a reminder that you can be really, really successful, really effective in loads of areas, really beautiful, really young looking, and still your cells are behaving a little bit older because your body never forgets.
So interesting.
Well, thank you.
Makes me
so
want to go out and study to be a doctor.
Oh, you'll do that next. Yeah. Excuse me, you already have a PhD. Only one woman on this sofa is without a PhD. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. And thank you, Nikki.
Thank you very much.
So interesting.
And if you want to learn more about Lola Young, you can read 8 weeks Looking Back, Moving Forwards, Defying the Odds, or just give her a call at the House of Commons.
Lords.
The Lords, which is anything but common. That was Baroness Lola Young, and you can be a baroness too if you suffer from hyperindependence as a trauma response. What a wonderful, inspirational woman. If you'd like to know more about her, you can get her book, 8 Weeks, Looking Back, Moving Forwards, and Defying the Odds. This has been What's My Age Again. Listen to our podcast and subscribe anytime.
This was a Rayo Original Podcast.